Hi, this is Corey Olson, the Tolkien Professor, and welcome to another episode of the Silmarillion Seminar.
Greetings, this is episode 29 of the Silmarillion Seminar, When You Wish Upon a Star, which covers the first half of chapter 24 of the Quinta Silmarillion, of the Voyage of Arendelle and the War of Wrath. I'm Matt Shaw from North Carolina, also known as Redneck Baron, or Baron from Dixie, because some participants who come from Boston think I talk funny. In my opinion, this chapter features one of the greatest characters chronicled in the Silmarillion, Arendelle the Mariner. Please indulge me for a moment while I wax poetic on my esteem for Arendelle. Arendelle is freaking awesome! Okay. When at one point in our discussion our gaze turns to the heavens, the Tolkien professor drops some knowledge on ancient Greek perspectives on astronomy. It may surprise you to learn that, as an undergraduate, Professor Olson double majored in English and astrophysics. What a combination. He also sang in a choral group and led the marching band. A practical Renaissance man. This session is an anomaly in that we stay pretty focused on discussing the text in question rather than taking things too far afield. However, have no worries, we go on wild tangents in our next session with even a mention of Mr. T. Yes, Mr. T. The Rocky III Mr. T, not the A-Team dude. Well, I hope you enjoy this episode.
Okay, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Silmarillion Seminar. Sorry we have a slightly late start tonight, but we've been having a hard time getting ourselves together. However, I think we are now assembled and ready to go. Now, I also realize that to some extent, I think my enthusiastic messages about ending the Quinta Silmarillion, which... Before we start, needless to say, I would like to recognize that I'm aware of the fact that I will have people actively trying to resist that project. But anyway, but finishing the Quinta Silmarillion has left some people confused and saying, does that mean this is the last episode of the Silmarillion Seminar? No, it's just the end of the Quinta Silmarillion, not the end of the entire book. We will still do the Akalabeth and the essay on the Rings of Power and the Third Age. But we've scheduled 2 weeks for each of those, I believe. So we still have 4 more weeks of stuff to go here. So we're not at the end of the seminar, but we are at the end of the Quinta Silmarillion, which is by far the largest chunk. There are the 5 different sections of the Silmarillion, the 1 short section on the Ainur Lindale, the 2nd short section on the Valle Quinta, and then finally the short section, and then at the end, the Akalabeth and the Rings of Power and the Third Age, but the central, I don't know what, 200 pages or so, is the Quinta Silmarillion, which we are now, tonight, coming to an end to. So that's kind of exciting. It's also kind of exciting that we are finally reaching the end of the downward spiral. We shall not be, it shall not just be getting more and more and more depressing as time goes on here. All right. So let's jump right into things, determined as we all are to get through this week. Okay. One thing that I would like to recognize from the beginning, kind of like I did last week, is basically sort of the roots of this. We've been looking at, a bunch of times we've been saying, wow, this chapter is really compressed. This, there's this sort of really quick survey of really big events, and we were looking at that last time. And with Tuor and the Fall of Gondolin, it's especially emphasized by the fact that there exists this much longer version of that story with, much more detail of the battles and everything else in the Lost Tales. The story of Arendelle is, in the one sense, similar in that, the story of Arendelle is a huge story, but it's even more tantalizing in that, unlike the earlier versions of The Fall of Gondolin, Tolkien never wrote it. He left outlines of what he wanted to do in the story of Arendelle at the beginning, but he never actually wrote the whole thing out. There doesn't exist, at least there has never been published, any kind of full-length version of the story of Arendelle, which is kind of interesting because although it, comes here at the end of the volume, chronologically, that is, chronologically in Tolkien's life, it was the beginning of the whole story. The story of Arendelle was the figure of Arendelle was one of the very first figures in Tolkien's mythology that he invented. In fact, many have made the argument that Arendelle himself is like the germ, or you know, the germ or the seed around which the entire mythology grew. And you know, we're told in one sentence in this chapter about the fact that he had a whole bunch of adventures, which we're not going to talk about. Let me see if I can find that sentence there. Yes. In the Lay of Earendil is many a thing sung of his adventures in the deep and in lands untrodden, and in many seas and in many isles. That's it. So, you know, we're told, like, this is another instance where we're told this story exists and it's out there, but you know, we don't have time to sing it now. And in this case, it never actually did come to exist. So again, I want to recognize the fact that although Earendil is really important in Tolkien's mythology, we don't, like the Fall of Gondolin, have those earlier texts to the same extent. One small tidbit that you might be interested in, based on his outlines, is that one of his adventures originally had been actually a toe-to-toe battle with Ungoliant. Ungoliant is also a very old figure in the mythology and dates back from, you know, she was one of the antagonists of Earendil during his adventures. Yes, Brandon is reminding us in the text of basically where that the concept of Earendil came from. And it came from a line of Anglo-Saxon poetry, which, read the line, the translation of the line here as Brandon has transcribed it: "Hail Earendil, brightest of angels, thou sent unto men upon this middle earth." And Tolkien read that and basically thought that there must be some mythological germ behind that, that he's sort of understood that Earendil, the bright angel, the brightest of angels, probably meant something like the morning or evening star, the morning and evening star, and he was basically kind of working that out into, you know, what that might look like, and his expansion of the story of Earendil, his desire to tell the untold story behind that line, which was a motivating force for so much of Tolkien's thought and so many of his stories, was where this concept came from. But anyway, so just a little bit there on the background so that we kind of know where we're coming from. But as usual, I want to, though there's much more that we could say, you know, I don't want to be going back and digging through, you know, there's a whole chapter on Earendil and some different versions of poems and things that Christopher Tolkien gives and talks about in the second volume of the Book of Lost Tales. But I want to focus our conversation on chapter 24 of the Quenta and really looking at Earendil here, especially in the context that he's given here. Because, of course, in that first version, Earendil doesn't have any of this kind of context. That is, if you think about the last chapter of the Quenta Silmarillion, in essence coming first, that, you know, we start with this idea of the figure of Earendil voyaging and adventuring and going into the West. If that's where we start without this whole backstory, it makes an enormous difference when you first have this entire history of Beleriand in the First Age and the Noldor and Morgoth and everything else and the Silmarils, and then you bring Earendil in at the climax of that story, at the very end of the story, as the instrument of Eucatastrophe. And so basically Earendil becomes so much has a completely different function within this version, and so, as I said, I would like to stick primarily to talking about that. But let's proceed with some attempt at method here, and let's start at the beginning. First section on the encampment by the mouths of Sirion, you know, from Earendil's wanderings through the last and cruelest of the slayings of elf by elf. Just first, the character of Earendil. What did you make of Earendil as we get him at the beginning here, just in these first two paragraphs, say? What we learn about him, what he does, how he is presented as a character. Thoughts? What struck you about this? Matt?
Well, seeing as we're so thorough, I don't know if I should jump right to the second paragraph and skip the first paragraph.
Hey, let's be rash. Let's go.
But what what struck me right away was his friendship with Círdan, and I just all the symbolism of them building this ship together, and it echoes back to the kinslaying and the burning of the ships. I mean, the ship is white, and he builds it with a Teleri, and of course the Teleri were subject to the kinslaying, and it's almost like the whole ship itself is a symbol of that redemption of the kinslaying.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that that's a really great point, Matt. And I think that you can see Arendal is like the culmination of everything here, right? I mean, he is the sort of distillation of almost everything that we've seen. If you look back at all the stories that we've read and all of the characters that we've been studying, Arendal's related by blood to almost all of them. I mean, he is like, you know, when he is the representative of the people, it's almost like he in himself is the representative of everybody, of the Noldor, of the Teleri, of the Maiar. He's related to Thingol and Melian. He's related to the Noldor through Idril. He's related to the House of Hador through Tuor. He's related to the House of Beor through Beren. He's just everywhere. And I think here in this moment, Matt, we can kind of see how through his actions, he ends up, once again, bringing, you know, you've got this, you know, he kind of enacts, in a sense, this reconciliation between, or at least foreshadows the reconciliation between Teleri and Noldor that we're going to see finally come at the end of the chapter and after the War of Wrath and the forgiveness that the Teleri are going to offer to the Noldor and his ship, Vingilot, we're told. And I think, you know, it's important, just as you say, Matt, to be remembering the ships that Feanor burned, because although those were the greatest of the, you know, those were the greatest ships ever made, and we're told, you know, they were like the Silmarils to the Teleri, yet we're told of Vingilot, the Foam Flower, that it is the fairest of the ships of song. So this one ship seems to be even greater individually than any of them were, even though they sort of as a fleet were the greatest. Vingilot still stands out. So we have this one. Well, I was going to say shining example, meaning it purely metaphorically, but of course, it is literally shining and will become literally shining. So you have the Silmaril of Feanor, and we were looking at the similarity between the ships of the Teleri that Feanor stole and the Silmaril that Feanor is trying to recover. You know, so in the story of Arendo, again, we get this combination, this coming together of the Teleri craft and the Noldor craft. So yeah, I think that that's a very important thing to be recalling. And this is in the sense, this is one of the biggest roles that Círdan plays. You know, we've talked, Círdan has come up a couple times, and, you know, but he's never been a huge major player. He's kind of a background character. And although he persists through the Lord of the Rings as a really background character in the Lord of the Rings, here, one of the actions that Círdan performs, which is sort of most significant in his career. The building of Vingilot is a very important moment. Go ahead, Matt.
Well, I was noticed that, you know, I've often thought about that. Círdan seems to be kind of one of the super elves, but he's always kind of on standby.
Right.
And that's almost kind of like his role. He's waiting the ages to bridge all these things together, you know, the Undying Lands with Middle Earth and the Rons between the Noldor and the Teleri. And, at one time, I don't want to jump ahead, of course, but at one time he actually possesses one of the rings of elven rings of power.
Right.
Passes it on to somebody important later on.
Right.
And he just seems to be a facilitator for a lot of the great deeds and actions and events of both in Aman and Middle-earth.
Yeah, I agree. Círdan is a really fascinating character, as we've talked about before, especially because he's so tantalizing with how much he is in the background and is on standby, as you say. I really like that. But, like, that's his job, right? And he occupies this middle ground that I find really interesting. You'll all doubtless remember with great detail and precision, all of the subdivisions of the Teleri as they moved west, and some of them split off and became the Nandor, and others split off to become the Sindar, and all of that stuff. But I think that Círdan and his followers, the Elves of the Falas, occupy a really interesting niche in the sort of large family tree of the different branches of the Teleri. Between the two sides, on the one hand, you've got the Teleri who do go all the way over to Valinor and who stay there, and then you've got the Teleri who never completed the journey at all, who, you know, the Green Elves, the Nandor, and even Thingol and his followers. But then you've got Círdan, who completes the journey and goes all the way to the coast and is there and he's ready to go. But he chooses to stay. He chooses to stay in Middle-earth, not because he doesn't want to go to Valinor, not because he forsakes the journey, but because he's like on standby. He wants to, you know, part of it is for the love that he bears to Ossé, we're told, you know, that Ossé came and befriended the Teleri there on the coast, and he's the one who taught them shipmaking and everything else. But again, he neither rejected the journey nor did he complete it, but he's there on the edge. He's this borderline figure on the coast. He's always on the coast. And as we see, he becomes, you know, he begins to look like the ferryman in the Third Age, right? He's the one who is the, it's not exactly a gateway. That's not the right metaphor, but he is the ferryman to Valinor. Again, sort of permanently, or well, not quite permanently, but anyway, long-term occupying that border position. And it's not just, you know, I think of the phrase that Feanor used when he accused the Teleri of being faint-hearted loiterers. Círdan is certainly not a faint-hearted loiterer. He makes being on standby a job there, and he's really working on it. Brandon just asked quickly in the text, was he at the Council of Elrond? No, he wasn't. He sent somebody. Galdor is the elf from the Havens, so he's like the Círdan's representative at the Council of Elrond, but Círdan himself doesn't come. Brandon, that's fascinating. The Ulmo connection, do you want to talk about that? I think that's a really neat parallel.
Well, between Círdan and Ulmo, I don't know. It just seems that they both have this love, and also with Arendo, they both have this longing, this for the sea, this love. Like their home is the ocean,
mm-hmm.
And it seems that they're very content to stay in that realm, if you will.
Yeah, and
that's really all I had to say about it.
No, that's true, and there's also we can see also, I think, a parallel in some sense, just as Ulmo keeps himself apart from the other Valar, and he's not separate from them in the sense of being at odds with them or anything like that, but he does go his own way, and he does hold himself aloof, and he also is kind of a boundary figure. That is, he's the one who is crossing over, who is interacting with the people of Middle-earth. And Círdan, too, keeps himself apart, not quite as, not solitary, not all by himself in the way that Ulmo does, but again, he doesn't fit into anybody else's category. He and his people are on their own. And I think that's kind of interesting. Joe, go ahead.
All right. I think later on in the text it mentions that Ulmo says it was Arendil's fate to come, but just in the beginning it talked about two purposes growing in his heart. He sought to sail out and for the wide sea, and then goes to Arnedrill. I didn't know if that could have been Ulmo working in him, or if it was just his fate altogether, because it seems like he's almost set on a path similar to Tuor, like something's going to happen, and he almost doesn't have a choice.
Yeah.
But I just wasn't sure what may have been acting in that.
Yeah, well, and I'm not sure that those two things are two separate options, really. That is Ulmo working on him and Ulmo working in his heart and his destiny. Because that's I would point, though, this is jumping ahead a little bit in the chapter. When we get that debate among the Valar, it's Ulmo who steps up and refers to his debate. That refers to his fate. Sorry. And I think that's, there it is. But almost said, "For this he was born into the world." Like, that was the coming here to Valinor was the point of him. That's why he was. That's why he was made. That's why he was. That's why. And remember, you know, Joe, as you're kind of reminding us here, he is the product. Eärendil is the product of the destiny of Tuor, which Ulmo particularly crafted. It was Ulmo who sent Tuor to Gondolin, and it was the destiny of Ulmo, you know, and sort of the hand upon Ulmo, which Turgon, even in his pride, could perceive, which led to the sort of permission for Tuor and Ingil to get married in the first place. So yeah, if Eärendil is the child of destiny, it's pretty clear that Ulmo has a pretty big share in that destiny. Let's see, John, thought I heard you click on there. Go ahead.
Well, first I wanted to address how in the beginning Eärendil is associated, I think, from his first mention with light. He's called Bright Eärendil, mm-hmm. which I believe to be a wonderful, you know, inclusion. We've mentioned the earlier Anglo-Saxon phrase, which I love. And I'd like to emphasize his identity as almost a divine servant. I mean, there's been many comparisons online, which I'm aware of calling the Silmarillion basically a Bible of Middle-earth, and I don't know if that's correct or incorrect to say, but I believe if there's one chapter which reflects especially the role of how one individual can basically, by divine grace, so basically seriously change the forces or the tides of fate, I believe this is the moment where Eärendil, I wouldn't say on his own, because he has Elwing eventually, but almost single-handedly turns basically the Valar as an act of providence towards the road to the, basically the final overthrow of Morgoth Baoglir. When we realize this, and when it's finally understood, we also need to understand a very, I think, understated note regarding this chapter. It's emphasized in the beginning, but nowhere else, that Eärendil is the Lord of the Havens, mm-hmm. where basically he is situated. He's basically running his own little show, and he leaves everything, almost to the point of the kinslaying, he's not there.
Right.
On basically this most perilous of all quests. It's this quest which basically draws him into basically the Tempest and eventually to the Undying Lands, while Elwing has to remain behind. I think that later on will be a note of Elwing's character. And having the Silmaril, I believe, with Eärendil is more part of his being and a part of his person and of almost like Vingulot. How those three, those twain, per se, are one in being, almost. A trinity which seems kind of odd at first, but there is symbolism at work in that sense. I don't think these are separate points in that they are unrelated, but together I think they form a very interesting picture of a prelude to what is definitely probably the most summarized and yet probably one of the most important missions and the most desperate in artist history.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot of those things, John, and I think that looking at the three of them together, one thing I would caution is that some of the connection between those three things that you were listing, that is Eärendil himself, the Silmaril, and Vingolot, certainly they're all closely tied together, and they do receive some similar kind of descriptions, but. I'm laughing. We have this text chat going on. You guys are always undermining me. And Jason was just quoting from making a joke about from Verlin Flieger's talk at MythCon a couple of weeks ago. Stop doing that, guys. Anyway, so the three of them, Eärendil, the Silmaril, and Vingolot, are connected together. But remember that this is because in part they are combined together later on. Eärendil is called Bright Eärendil at the beginning because he's going to come to be known. So when we introduce the story of Eärendil here, the elves who are telling this story in the Silmarillion already know it, and so does the audience, which is usual when telling great and legendary stories like this. And so they call him Bright Eärendil, which works as a kind of, you know, foreshadowing in a sense of what's gonna happen later on, but he's referred to Bright Eärendil because his destiny is going to be, he's going to become a star, and Vingolot is going to become his his vehicle as a star, and the Silmaril is the light of the star, and so those three things are going to be unified in function and therefore all associated together. But I don't think necessarily that we can just sort of simply go backwards and connect all three of those things equally from the beginning. Vingolot, I would emphasize, for instance, is it's the fairest of the ships of song, and it's we get some descriptions of it, and it's connected with, on the one sense with heavenly things. That is, it sails, whereas the Argent Moon, Argent just meaning silver there. It's got silver sails and golden oars and white timbers, but its name, Vingolot, means the foam flower, which doesn't have anything to do with stars or light, as it's going to go on to be, but it's the foam flower, and this, I think, I would connect back with what Matt was saying before. It is like the flower of all ships. I mean, it is the of the ships that ride on the foam of the sea. It is the flower, and it is beautiful like a flower. But anyway, I think that. But nevertheless, I do agree that they certainly are associated together, and they certainly are. Eärendil. You think of how Bilbo starts his song in Rivendell. Eärendil was a mariner, and that is his central identity. That one of the defining things about his character is that longing that he has for the wide sea. And it's interesting, you can see this. And here again, as usual, I say, let's not talk about the Book of Lost Tales, and then I continue to go back and make references to it. So, I'm sorry for always, as I usually do, continually breaking my own rules. But one small interesting point is that the name of Eärendil is used briefly at the beginning of the Book of Lost Tales in Volume 1, not as a reference to a particular event in the story of Eärendil, but as a general term, that somebody who is a wanderer, someone who has the desire to travel by sea and explore new lands and things, is generically called a child of Eärendil. And so from the beginning, Eärendil is associated with that longing, is almost identified with that longing. I think that's a really crucial thing. But let's move on to the kinslaying and Elwing, and Elwing's reunion here with Eärendil. Not quite final thoughts on the Sons of Feanor. We'll get back to them, final thoughts on this third kinslaying. This one is a little over the top. This one is a little, it is certainly the cruelest. What do you make of this, Dave?
I think it's interesting that each subsequent kinslaying has become just like more and more horrendous. Mm-hmm. And of course, Tolkien points this out in the text. I mean, you would think at some point that maybe these guys would say, like, how about you guys, how about you come on over to our place Thursday next week, we'll cook dinner, we'll buy the drinks, and we can sit and have a chat about this. But now that they don't even bother trying to organize things anymore, or they don't even try to impose terrible modern vernacular on it, they're not even trying diplomacy, because what's interesting here is that Tolkien points out that the people of the Havens are reluctant to give up the stones, in large part because the people that had, obtained them and passed them on to them had suffered through so much, Lúthien, Beren, Dior, Thingol. But also they point out, and especially because they have this sort of vague notion that it's would be really bad to give up the Silmaril while Eärendil's on the sea. And I don't know, maybe they didn't mention this in their reply to the Sons of Feanor, but suppose that they did. The Sons of Feanor could have said, well, okay, fine, why don't we wait till Eärendil comes back, and then maybe we can get together with him and chat with him. But they're just not even trying. I mean, I feel like that at this point, they're not even some decent guys who are constrained by a really stupid oath and are just making the most of it. I mean, they really have become bad guys at this point. And indeed, I guess this is why eventually their oath is rendered vain. And I do hope we have a chance a little bit later to revisit our long-standing debate on odes. Are they good or bad? Because I think this chapter is the culmination in the oaths in and of themselves are not good. Bad oaths are bad. Maybe right. Good oaths can be good, but there certainly are bad oaths, and this one's a bad one.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, and you're certainly right. I mean, there's no sense in which this debate between them, you know, or the, you know, their approach to Elwing and them, as you say, they're not even really trying diplomacy, and it's cruelest is I think the important word here. This is not even war. This is a massacre. This is a refugee camp. This is the last remnant of the elves in Beleriand that they are coming down and stomping on. But one thing that I would qualify, I agree with you about 75%, Dave. The one thing I would qualify, because it's the part that I find most interesting about the Sons of Feanor here. On the one hand, I totally agree. Their oath is driving them to talk about the burden of the oath, but of the accursed oath. Strong words here. However, they're not just. It's Maglor and Mythros who are the last two, and they're the ones who win the day, and they're the ones who do the butchering. And they, from the beginning, those two have been the nicest of all of the Sons of Feanor. The really bad guys we've already killed off. I mean, they died in Doriath. Celegorm and Curufin and Caranthir, they're gone. The ones who have been jerks from day one and were getting worse and worse, like Celegorm especially. But here, Mythros, we've seen Mythros struggling with this and even resisting before the fulfillment of the oath, as when he didn't insist on the Silmaril right away after Beren and Luthien got it, and instead tried to form a union, which of course ends disastrously in the Nir-Nyth Arnoidiad, but still good idea, as we talked about at the time. Mythros has clearly has been trying at times. Maglor, also, you know, one of the first times that we hear about Maglor, we know that he is a mighty singer. And the first time, I think the very first time his name comes up individually, other than in a list, is after the kinslaying. When we're told about the kinslaying, that is kinslaying number one, back in Aqualande, and Maglor is the one who makes the song of lament about the fall of the Noldor and about the kinslaying and what a horrible thing it was. So we know that Maglor too, like Mythros, is not just a sort of a frothing at the mouth monstrous villain figure. So it's like it's the two most sympathetic of the Sons of Feanor, and I realize that it's a very relative category, but the two most sympathetic Sons of Feanor who survive. And I think that one of the effects that has is it prevents us simply from at least me anyway, from completely writing them off and saying they are to use Sam's or Frodo's expression in The Return of the King, that they're worse than an orc and merely an enemy. In a sense, yes, but again, if it were Celegorm and Curufin who were the last two survivors, no question. But since it's Maglor and Mythros, I think it's a little bit different. But Chris, go ahead.
I guess just wanted to jump in with an illustration on just how rock bottom that these guys have hit, and I think it's interesting that you brought up that they are, at least have been, the most sympathetic. The group under Elwing, they don't. I get the impression they probably don't have a lot of weapons. So you're right; it is a slaughter. And
Remember that Glamdring and Orcrist came out of Gondolin. Now, they probably don't have them, the refugees, because that is the implication in The Hobbit, is that Glamdring and Orcrist came to the trolls who had plundered other plunderers, and that it was handed down through the dragons and people who sacked Gondolin. However, the Gondolindrim had some pretty sweet weapons, so those who survived might still have some. But anyway, I'm quibbling. Go ahead.
But overall, I don't think they had. I guess my impression was they weren't as well armed. But I guess the nature of them really hitting rock bottom, that their own thoughts followers. Some of them step aside and not participate, and some of them jump over to Elwing's side and start fighting against them, and then they get killed too for doing that. But they're pretty much literally alone, just two of them at the end.
Yeah.
They don't really have any followers who are with them.
Yeah, and certainly the very end that we see of Maglor and Mytheros is them completely alone. I agree. I think that's... We do see that division, and I was going to talk about Elrond and Elros, but I'll wait because a couple of people want to talk, and I don't want to steal anybody's thunder. Jack, go ahead.
I just wanted to add, in their defense, yes, they're doing heinous things, but they would give anything to be out from under this oath, and I think that's clear in this chapter. They have long discussions about how to go about fulfilling this oath and what's the lesser of two evils. And I think it's clear that they want out from it, but they don't know how to do that. And the oath drives them. And that's why a couple months ago, I asked about the oath, because I didn't fully understand it, the power of these oaths. And obviously, it's so powerful that it drives good elves, to do heinous things.
Yeah, I think that's important to remember, that it's not just a question of them making a bad choice. This is them being driven by it. I mean, I'd want to read that phrase at the bottom of 246. Now when first the tidings came to Mytheros that Elwing yet lived and dwelt in possession of the Silmaril by the mouths of Sirion, he, repenting of the deeds in Doriath, withheld his hand. So as Jack says, he doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want to go. He wants to not do anything. But in time, the knowledge of their oath unfulfilled returned to torment him and his brothers, and gathering from their wandering hunting paths, they sent messages to the havens of friendship and yet of stern demand. They are tormented. There is a sense here, I think, that we are supposed to take that there is a kind of compulsion on them. I am not sure here that their wills are entirely free in this matter. There does seem to be a power that the oath has over them. They're not like robots here, but there is more than just, well, we should probably fulfill the oath. I think that's we need to be careful in thinking about that, because I agree, Jack, we can see the way that the oath is talked about, especially, and I would come back to that significant phrase, the accursed oath. The oath is a curse on itself. We've seen curses acting. We've seen the curse of Morgoth acting on Turin, for instance. And we know that his own will was involved there, but also there were some things that were not his will, and that were the curse of Morgoth imposed upon him. And I think that we can see a similar kind of balance here. Their own oath has become a curse. But Jason, you wanted to weigh in here too on...
Yeah, I wanted to agree with Jack and also point out that maybe there's something to be said for the argument that since the people on the other side of this demand, whether it's Elwing or Thingol earlier or Dior, they know the oath is there. They know that the sons of Feanor are being driven by this thing. Maybe there's something to be said for the position that they're just being bullheaded and not giving them the Silmaril, because a lot of this bloodshed could have been avoided.
Yeah, and that seems to be especially true of Dior. That sense of... As we were discussing earlier about the sense that they have, it seemed to them that in the Silmaril lay the healing and the blessing that had come upon their houses and their ships. You gotta wonder if they're quite right about that. Certainly the outcome of having the Silmaril is not healing and blessing. I think that, yeah, should they have given it up? Maybe. Would not yield the jewel which Beren had won and Luthien had worn, like the Silmaril has been re-hallowed by the story of Beren and Luthien, and for which Dior the Fair was slain. But again, Jason, as you say, yet Dior the Fair was slain because he wouldn't give it up either. And it seems, as Jordan suggested in his paper at MythCon, that Dior too was succumbing to some of that same pride that Thingol had been experiencing too. Joe, go ahead.
All right. I was just going to say, it's just really interesting that I know the Valar have a lot of power. I mean, they take care of a lot of stuff. But, I mean, you're just kind of reading this, and, you know, Ulmo bore up Elwing out of the waves, and he gave her the likeness of a great white bird. And it's just like, wait a minute, he just transformed her into a bird.
Yep.
He can do that?
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, I've never really thought about it like that before, but I did not know they had that sort of power over the physicality of the children of Luthor. That was just, I've thought about it in a certain way this time, and just never really realized that before.
Yeah, that is, I have always found Elwing's initial transformation into a bird, and apparently her subsequent ability to change herself into a bird at will, that is in the sort of retirement phase of Arendel and Elwing's life, that she flies up to meet him in bird form, though those words are not used. That seems to be what we are to understand, that the birds taught her. I mean, let me find that passage, because I think the phrasing is really fascinating because it's indirect. The March of the Valar. Let's see. I'm totally flailing on finding the right paragraph here. Does anybody have it? The place, Brandon, it looks like you were looking at the passage where she's able to speak to the birds.
Yeah, I'm trying to find it too. Let's see.
And it is said that Elwing learned the tongue of birds, herself had once worn their shape.
Got it. Where is this, Mike?
They taught her the craft of flight, and her wings were white and silver gray.
There you go. Which page is this? Is this mine?
I have the paperback version, so my page numbers won't match yours.
Okay. Oh well. Well, anyway, there it is. Just found it. 250. Yes, it is said that Elwing learned the tongues of birds, who herself had once worn their shape, and they taught her the craft of flight. Now, see, they taught her the craft of flight makes it just sound like they taught her how to fly. But it's clear from the rest of that sentence, and her wings were of white and silver gray, that she is again taking the form of a bird. When doing that, that teaching the craft of flight means learning how to turn yourself into a bird. But Joe, to get back to your observation, again, we've been looking at Ulmo being sort of pretty heavy-handed in his interventions here, especially with Tuor, but that's like nothing compared to what he does with Elwing here. Elwing throws herself into the sea with the Silmaril, and he prevents her, and he transforms her into a bird and flies her out and transforms her back, apparently, and brings her, reuniting her with Arendelle. So, I mean, that's a pretty direct hand that Ulmo is taking. If Arendelle makes it back to Valinor, but it is certainly not entirely on his own. Ulmo has played a huge part in making that happen. No wonder he's speaking up for him in the council afterwards. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
No.
I just didn't know that they had that kind of authority. Because it seems like a lot of times you're like, oh, we need to, it's with men more than elves, but we need to step back and let Luvatar take care of this because this is out of our jurisdiction. A lot of those decisions, like I said, mostly with men, it just seems like they stay away from, but I mean, I guess this is kind of almost a different story here, so.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, it certainly is a departure from the kind of thing we've seen. Even when we've seen interventions, like, for instance, the very brief reference to the fact that when Fingon is rescuing Mithros way back near the beginning of the Quenta, right after, you know, when Mithros is stapled to the wall of Thangorodrim, and Fingon prays to Manwë, and Thorondor the Eagle, wham, is there and helps him. Even that kind of an intervention is nothing like this. Nobody does anything to either of them. You know, that is, there's no just like, and Fingon was transformed and lifted up and, you know, or Mithros was swept away or nothing like that has happened. So, I mean, Joe, I think you're right to point this out, that is a pretty remarkable moment. Even Ulmo before has been sending messengers and guiding people and calling people and, he was orchestrating events pretty clearly in Tuor's story, but again, still no kind of intervention quite like this. Elwing therefore becomes, I think, a really interesting figure. Therefore, one of the ones who is most directly touched and used as this kind of, as this very direct instrument by the Valar, or at least by a Valar being being Ulmo. Mike, you wanted to speak before, did you? And now that you've got your mic working, you had a couple observations on this section that I would that I'd love to hear you talk about.
Sure. Well, I guess the one that I very much like the imagery of Arendil when he is setting out for Valinor, and you don't yet get the full image of him with sailing his ship, holding the rudder, where he has fully become Arendil the Mariner, capital E, capital M.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, he's depicted as basically being leaning over sort of the bow of the ship with the Silmaril on his, you know, on his forehead. So he's playing a less active role here, it seems to me, where he's sort of divinely being guided to where he needs to be. And I think that increases the power and the impact of the depiction of Arendil later in the chapter when he fully becomes the fully realized Mariner, capital M. He's not there yet. He is a Mariner who has been given this incredible jewel that has this incredible power, but he is not at the helm. Elwing is not at the helm. He's leaned across the bow, and it the way it's written, it appears like he's being drawn to where he needs to be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and then he becomes the beacon. With Silmaril as lantern light. I keep finding Bilbo's song of Arendil the Mariner is possibly one of my top three favorites of all of Tolkien's poems, and I find lines from that song keep kind of floating up into my mind as we're talking about it. And Mike, I was really interested in the point that you made also about Elwing and Arendil and the imagery we get with the two of them.
Oh yeah, I'll submit that this is the most intimate and tender depiction of a couple together that we get in the entire book. Maybe I'm missing something, but the depiction of Arendil's bosom and then Elwing falling asleep beside him with her hair upon his face and then her falling asleep.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a very, you know, we talk about the narrator raising or lowering the level of detail. Here we've got a very specific and tender and intimate depiction of them together. And I don't know if there's anything equivalent to that in any other passages we've read about other couples through the book.
No, I think that's a really fantastic point. And that specific marital image that is of the emphasis on them not as lovers, you know, not as like, you know, Beren seeing Luthien you know, through the trees and being, you know, staggered by her beauty or anything like that. This is a very domestic moment, and fascinating that we get in this chapter, which is sailing miles and miles above the action. That is, we're going so fast. It's such a short survey of all of these things. You know, we got the synopsis of like, oh, and he had a whole bunch of adventures, which gets a whole epic poem in half a sentence, and yet we swoop in, not for a dramatic moment like that passage from the Nirnaeth Arnoediad I like to quote, but for this moment, as you say, Mike, of domestic tenderness. And it is sung that she fell from the air. And again, notice, again, for some more style time moments, with that beginning, and it is sung that, normally that's a prelude to some, you know, sort of wide epic event, and it is sung that, we're thinking about, like, you know, Húrin crying out every time that he slays an enemy, and 70 times he shouted those words. No, instead, what it is sung about is, and it is sung that she fell from the air upon the timbers of Vingolot in a swoon, nigh unto death for the urgency of her speed, and Arendil took her to his bosom. But in the morning, with marveling eyes, he beheld his wife in her own form beside him, with her hair upon his face, and she slept. Another one of those wonderful, and we've noticed this stylistic turn in the Silmarillion many times before, that final little brief noun, verb, simple sentence combination, and she slept. and Morgoth came. But here it's, and she slept. He beheld his wife in her own form beside him with her hair upon his face. And I do agree with you, Mike. We've gotten husbands and wives. We've seen, some pretty important couples together before. Baron and Luthien, obviously. Even people like Húrin and Morwen are an important couple. Kind of creepily, Túrin and Nienor. But here we get this image of Rhiannon. That detail about her hair upon his face. I just love that. Again, there's nothing quite that tender. I think that seems to me the right word here. But let's actually, since we're on this subject, continue with it. There are several possible parallels, right, between Eärendil and Elwing and Beren and Luthien. There are numerous times when we are invited to connect those couples together. What do we do with those? What are your thoughts about sort of the similarities and differences between Eärendil and Elwing as a pair and Beren and Luthien as a pair? Dave?
Well, I think the most essential quality that is a similarity between the two couples is the fact that they stick together. That was something that you really strongly emphasized about Beren and Luthien, particularly about Luthien, that she insisted all along the way, every time he tried to leave her behind or say, you know, like, oh, no, I need to go on my way, this final step, you go back where it's safe. I'm going to take one for the team here. She insisted, nope, we're in this together. We're in this together. And ultimately, his success in obtaining the Silmaril is largely due to her presence, the fact that she came along.
Right.
And you pointed out multiple times where the elves' plans to try and defeat Morgoth, although they were sort of pointless in the long run, that their attempts certainly would have met with at least greater success if they had stuck together, and that nobody seemed to learn the lesson of Beren and Luthien. But it appears that Eärendil and Elwing did learn that lesson. Well, maybe Eärendil didn't, because he kept trying to leave her behind
right.
also.
Elwing
learned it.
Yes.
Elwing learned the lesson. As usual, it's the women. The women are the ones who actually see what's going on. The men are oblivious as usual.
Right.
And of course, if we are to trust the wise, what the wise say, which is that the jewel was the reason for them making their ways out of the enchantments of the Enchanted Isles and through the shadows of the Shadowy Waters, that the Silmaril was the reason for that, then ultimately Eärendil's success is largely due to Elwing's presence. Although, of course, you can only take that so far, because in the end he does manage to leave her behind. He does deliver the errand by himself. So.
Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, I just to hold on for a second on that specific parallel. I think it's really fascinating when you look at the contrasts in the situations. The primary moment, the moment that we spent most time on with Beren and Luthien, when Beren is trying to leave her behind, this is the time when he sings his song, when he does briefly leave her behind, and then he sings his song, you know, his "That Luthien for a Time Should Be" song. And this is when he's taking the last step. Like, they've escaped everything else they've gotten. He's right on the edge of Anfauglith, he's going to go up to Angband. So I won't take her with me into darkness. I'm going to leave her here where she'll be comparatively safe, and Huon is here too, and so that's all good. Here, it's not into Angband. It's the opposite. It's into Valinor, right? It's, you know, into blessedness, into light, instead of into darkness. Yet, of course, it's still into peril. It's still into danger. He still fears destruction and doesn't want to lead her to certain destruction. Remember, Beren is being sent to certain destruction on purpose. That was Thingol's plan. Eärendil, of course, not in that same situation, but yet again, I think it's to me, I think, very evocative that certain doom for those two characters, that what they are trying to spare their beloveds from, unwisely, as Dave, of course, rightly points out, but still with good intentions, seem so diametrically opposed, and yet in practice are pretty similar. Jason, did I steal your point there?
Well, you started to go off in a different direction from what I was going to talk about, but
okay.
Since you called on me, I'll say
sure,
it anyway.
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
I got the idea that in a lot of ways the Arendelle and Elwing relationship is more traditional. I mean, Elwing is more of a passive figure. We don't see her, you know, blowing away a fortress or, you know, putting Morgoth to sleep or anything like that. And Arendelle is more the man of action who's taking, you know, being out in front, doing things. And in other ways, you know, you don't have Arendelle sort of marrying up to Elwing the way you have with Beren, who's, you know, Luthien is clearly above him in status and all that, but Arendelle and Elwing seem to be a lot more equal in that respect.
Yeah, it's true. That certainly is a big contrast between the two of them. I don't think, because even the elven, I mean, both of them have both human and elven ancestors. Arendelle's elven ancestors are higher. Now, Elwing comes from Melian, so she is of divine race, as it says. But yet, certainly, I agree, he is the one who is the instrument of destiny, and he is the one who is the lord of the city, and he is, or the lord of the you know, the havens that they've made down there at the mouth of Sirion. So I agree with you. There is not there that same sense that we get in most of the other significant couples like that, that we get Tuor and Idril themselves, Beren and Luthien, Arwen and Aragorn, Thingol and Melian. Nowhere do we here we don't get that same kind of parallel. And I agree, Elwing is definitely more passive, even in, as we were looking at, you know, sort of as an extension of the point that Joe was making about Ulmo and his intervention here. We can also see that even the one thing that she does, and as Dave was pointing out, it is essential. Her participation is essential. If she hadn't brought the Silmaril to him, he would not have been able to succeed. But bringing the Silmaril to him, it's not obvious that that was her plan. Ulmo conveys her to them. Now, she's apparently flapping her wings real hard. I mean, I don't want to, you know, like, take away from the fact that she's obviously putting a lot of effort into this. You know, she falls in a swoon. But again, she has been lifted up by Ulmo. And again, she, like Tuor in the previous chapter, is the instrument for what Ulmo is clearly bringing about, I think, here. It does make her, if not a completely passive figure, certainly, as you say, Jason, she's no Luthien. Brandon?
Yeah, I don't know if this is more of implied in the text or is in the text, but it seems that Mandos is kind of the another parallel between Beren and Luthien. It seems that the Valar have sort of pity for them both. And it says in the text, Mandos answered equally the Noldor, who went willfully into exile, may not return hither. But when all was spoken, Manwë gave judgment. And so it seems that it's implied that Mandos is kind of moved by this and can't be objective. So Manwë gives the judgment. So perhaps maybe another parallel is Mandos is moved by these two kindreds?
Possibly. I'm not sure. I mean, Mandos is kind of playing bad cop here in this exchange. He's the one who speaks up first and is like, shall mortal men step living upon the undying lands and yet live? That is, he seems to be playing the heavy here, who's saying, well, okay, we're all glad to see Arendelle and everything, and this is awesome, and let's totally go kick Morgoth, but we should totally kill him. That it's like, he should die because he came here and he shouldn't have. It was, you know, yes, we're all glad to see him and everything, but it still breaks the rule. And then, you know, an Ulmo is the one who is playing good cop there. You know, for this he was born into the world. It is his destiny. Seriously, you're going to blame him for this? And hey, you know, he's like as much elf as he is man, so that's okay. And then Mandos is disagreeing with that. No. Being an Noldor is hardly an excuse, right? No. So in fact, that just means he should be twice condemned, because he transgressed, he trespassed in Valinor, not only as a mortal man, but also as an exiled Noldor breaking banishment. Therefore, out with him. And then Manwë, again, he doesn't say the out with him business, but that does seem to be the line that Mandos is saying, that Mandos is being the voice of justice here, strict justice. And he is, you know, Manwë doesn't side with him. So I don't really see Mandos having sympathy himself here. He is articulating what strict justice, of course, as we saw in the previous passage, the same strict justice that Earendil assumes is going to come down on him. That's what makes this whole thing so dangerous. It's a very different kind of danger from Morgoth, but yet, nevertheless, there's still that same kind of transgression, and he, like Beren, assumes he's going to get destroyed. But Manwë has the power of doom, which, again, a very important word when in the context of fate. You know, think of the different ways that that concept is brought in here. Mando spoke concerning his fate, meaning what was going to happen to him, what his what punishment they're going to give him. And Omo says, for this he was born into the world. In other words, it is his fate. And then Manwë says, the power of doom is given to me. Doom, again, being, at least in some context, a synonym of fate here, too, but meaning also judgment. So I think it's that play here in these paragraphs is really interesting, both recognizing the existence of fate as this kind of external thing, but also their own power of deciding his fate and of decreeing a doom and having the power of doom. We've kind of skipped over Earendil's arrival, which I don't want to do. Two details that we should mention. First, the emptiness and that sort of the kind of strange detail, the strange and apparent anticlimax, at least from Earendil's perspective, when he arrives and he's like, here I am in Valinor. Where is everybody? What do you make of that? What is interesting, what is significant about there being nobody there? And he, to the point where he actually thinks, oh my gosh, something horrible has happened. There's been, like, I don't know, pestilence or something. Everyone in Valinor has died of the plague. Has some evil befallen Valinor? This seems like a strange kind of anticlimax. Anyone have thoughts on this moment? Of course, as Brandon points out, you know, and the text emphasizes the significance of the time of festival. People show up unexpectedly at times of festival so frequently, you would think that we would have come to expect it by now, but Laura?
I was just going to point out the obvious, in that every other time there's a festival and everyone's away, it's usually something horrible that's happening. But this time it's something else that's eucatastrophic instead of being catastrophic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. No, and I think that this is the moment, in a sense, which you know, the parallel offers a kind, too grandiose to say, sort of healing, but there is a kind of reversal, especially, specifically, the reversal of the one that is recalled. The last time we saw a festival in Valimar was when, as the text reminds us, when Morgoth and Ungoliant came in and destroyed the trees. So, just as in that moment the light of the trees departed, now, in that same kind of moment, during a time of festival, the light of the trees is returning in the Silmaril. Brandon, go ahead.
I was just going to say that when Earendil calls to Earendil, when he's just at the last moment when he thinks about going back to the sea, he hears a great voice calling, "Hail Earendil, of mariners most renowned, but cometh unawares, the longed for, that cometh beyond hope. Hail Earendil, bearer of light, before the sun and moon." So this is a light, the Silmaril is before the sun and the moon, even. It seems that the Valar seem to even be surprised. That is, they seem to have their own eucatastrophe,
mm-hmm.
their own eucatastrophic moment there. And it shows kind of the limitations of the Valar and how they don't know how the music is going to be played out. And this is one of the instances in where they did not expect this to happen. And they're like, another, you know, that Iluvatar, he's at it again. It's just, you know, I don't know. It seems to be one of those moments.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. And I think that that set of titles that he is given by Eonwe, when Eonwe, you know, notices him and makes his declaration there, I think it's a fascinating set of titles, but my favorite are those ones that you read, the looked for that cometh at unawares, the longed for that cometh beyond hope. Yeah, Mike, go ahead.
I viewed the silence purely as a stylistic choice where, in the same way that if this was a musical composition, at the moment before the brilliant trumpet fanfare, there's almost always a pause or a dimming of the action to amplify even more the trumpet or the horn call that signals the arrival. And so for me, I really didn't spend too much time thinking through why, you know, in terms of the story itself. For me, it was purely to bring out the trumpet call of the herald of Manway and his calling to him, you know, out of the silence. So that was my take on it.
Yeah, I do agree that it has that effect. But the part that always gets me, the part that I think actually strikes a different kind of note there, to use your musical metaphor, is the fact that he has actually started, he's turned back. Therefore, he turned back at last towards the sea. But even as he took the shoreward road, one stood upon the hill and called to him in a grave voice. He has turned around and started to go home. You know, in that moment of, here, Rendell standing there being like, well, that didn't pan out. You know, here I finally got to Valinor, and, you know, it's like, Arendelle, you've made it to Valinor. What are you going to do now? And he's like, hey, well, nothing. Like, go home, I guess. There's nobody here. I kind of expected it would be a little bit different from this. That moment is brought out enough, I think, that it becomes its own sort of note. And then I do agree with you, Mike, then that the disappointment, the confusion of Arendelle is shattered by Eonwe, not just the fact that, you know, there he is and that he's speaking, but in what he says. Hail, Eärendil, of mariners most renowned, the looked for that cometh at unawares. Yeah, you caught us on the hop, but we were waiting for you. The longed for that cometh beyond hope. That not only is everything okay, and that it isn't, in fact, in the end, anticlimactic, but that he was in fact expected, and they know who he is, and that he was coming. Dave,
I have just an idle musing about Eomwe's voice. Mm-hmm. So they say that he shouts in a great voice. I don't think the word is actually shouts.
Called to him, yeah.
That Arendelle hears a great voice. What'd you say?
Called to him in a great voice, is that?
Yes, called to him in a great voice, yeah. which doesn't actually. I mean, I think we sort of interpret that to mean he yelled, but it called doesn't actually necessarily imply any sort of particular volume. And Martin Shaw's audiobook shouts it. But I was just imagining as I was on my run today listening to this and imagining, like, did he actually shout? Because you would imagine that a Valar, especially Eonwe, the herald of Manway, if he really shouted, I mean, you'd be able to hear all the way across Arda. And certainly, you know, someone like, for example, Morgoth would have heard and perhaps might have had a better idea that somebody was coming for him later. So I was just imagining, like, I wonder what that call was like. Was it indeed sort of a voluminous, loud, you know, shout? Or was it, you know, I don't know, something more where it could have been just a whisper, but somehow it reached Arendil and penetrated him? I don't know. I was just musing about that. I don't think there's actually any way to actually figure out what it would have been. There's nothing in the text, as Verlin Flieger would have said. But.
Right, right. And as you say, I mean, even just the circumstances, I mean, if he were shouting, then, you know, Arendelle could easily say, well, first of all, I'm right here. And secondly, it's just me. I mean, you don't have to project like it's there. We're the only two people here. You can just talk straight to me. But again, I think that's again the, and here to come back to Mike's image of the fanfare. What Eonwe is doing here is not just, hey, I've got something to communicate to you, Arendelle, walking down there on the road, and heck, I'm just gonna let this thing rip and shout it real loud. He is proclaiming something. This is the moment where, and this is why this is Eonwe himself doing this, the herald of Manway. He is proclaiming that the moment has come, that Eärendil, this is a turning point in the whole history of Arda, and it has to be proclaimed. And so it is proclaimed in a great voice, whether that means he's shouting or not. He is uttering a weighty thing in a portentous voice and with very high rhetoric. And so this is clearly not the goal of this speech, is definitely not merely interpersonal communication. Joe, go ahead.
There's really not a whole lot to this, but I just think it's interesting that during the time of festival, whether you're trying to sneak in, like Melkor and Ungoliant, or trying to like come in with like a big bright light on your forehead and covered in diamond dust shining, I mean, no one seems to notice you. I mean, no matter what you're doing, it's just kind of funny because it's complete opposites and still nothing.
Yes, cloaked in darkness, radiant with light. Yeah, none of that is really picked up on. But it's pretty clear that the perimeter security by the Valar just really has not improved. Mike, go ahead.
I like the fact that the way he writes this, we hear the trumpet blast of the proclamation out of nowhere in the same way that Eärendil does in that final sentence before we get the actual proclamation. All we know is one stood upon the hill and called to him. We don't get the Herald of Manwë saw that Eärendil was walking away and called him and said, We don't get that. Instead, we get, and we sort of are put in the shoes of Eärendil himself, that confusingly, out of nowhere, comes this great voice crying. And so we experience that paragraph sort of with the immediacy that Eärendil does.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, we're then told that voice was the voice of Manwë,
right.
Herald of Manwë. And then we get that detail afterwards.
Yeah. There is that moment. That voice was the voice of Manwë is definitely a shift back to that higher narrative register that not quite omniscient frame, but the sort of legend recounting, I'm telling you the whole backstory frame, and not just from Eärendil's perspective. I agree. What do you make of the last sentence? And Brandon, when you were reading this, you stopped short of the last sentence. But what do you guys make of that? Splendor of the children of Earth, star in the darkness, jewel in the sunset, radiant in the morning. So you're Eärendil, as Mike has pointed out, we've sort of been looking at this paragraph from Eärendil's point of view, and then we get not only this great voice suddenly saying saying some fairly odd things. Splendor of the children of Earth. Jack?
Well, it almost seems like they knew what they were going to do with him. I mean, later on they're going to shoot him up into space and he's going to be the morning star and the evening star. So, yeah, maybe Eärendil didn't know this, but it seems that they did.
Yeah. No, and you can see his destiny is clear there. And I think that this moment helps us to see the significance of that destiny. He is the splendor of the children of Earth. And I don't think that necessarily means or simply means, Eärendil, I want to let you know, you are the awesomest of all of the children of Iluvatar. Okay. You've proven that you are the best out of everybody. Splendor is an important word there. That is, he is the shiniest of all of the children of the Earth. Well, yes, of course, because he's wearing the Silmaril on his brow and he's covered with diamond dust, and he's going to be made into a star. So, yes, he's going to have more splendor than anybody else, because he is, in fact, going to be radiant in the morning. But, of course, we can also see here the significance of the whole morning and evening star thing, right? He is a star in the darkness, jewel in the sunset, radiant in the morning. He is the one who ushers in this transition between the night and the day, but also the day and the night. He is the evening and he is the evening star and he is the morning star. He is the star whose rising signals the end. So he is there, and he is the evening star of the first age, but he is also the morning star of what is to come. He is a star. He will be a star in the darkness. like the star that Sam sees through the clouds, through the shadow in Mordor. He is, you know, so we can see him both at the dawn of things, but also at the closing of things. And again, here I think back also to that parallel, or sort of that anti-parallel, with Morgoth and Ungoliant, the ending of the Light of the Trees and the return of the Light of the Trees, the light from before the sun and moon. Joe, go ahead.
This is kind of getting away from subject a little bit. This is just about Randall himself. Just, you really see how not like a great person, but I mean, when he's pleading for the case of, like, both races of the Children of Luvatar, both elves and men, and for the Noldor and all of their, you know, woes, and this is while some Noldor just, like, stole his two kids, and I mean, I don't think he was pleading for the Sons of Feanor specifically, but I mean, he's going through a rough time himself, and here he is pleading for everybody else. I mean, it just seems like, not that there's already forgiveness in his heart, but he's just already doing this for other people, and then it also later talks about him pretty much siding up with Elwing, whatever she chooses to do. I mean, he's just, he's very selfless, and again, it seems like a case of him being rewarded, as you see later on, for being so selfless.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point, especially the business about the Sons of Feanor, which of course, as we with his sons, and of course we know, though he and Elwing don't know, that actually Elrond and Elros are fine. And in another moment, this is a point I was going to bring up a long time ago, but I forgot to, so I'll do it now. The love that we are told that grows between Elrond and Maglor and Maedhros, is another, I think, pretty clear prompt, not just to look at Maglor and Maedhros as slavering monsters. They are, Elrond, certainly of all people, is not going to strike up a really close friendship and come to love them if there's nothing lovable about them anymore. But anyway, as Joe says, for all Arendelle knows, not only are his kids dead, but they are dead at the hands of some of these same Noldor that he is coming to petition for. So I agree, he is not just representing, you know, himself and his own suffering. He's not only there as the representative of everybody, and as you know, I said before, he's like the distillation of everybody in the First Age, but he is also clearly representing his enemies. Then the Valar took counsel together, and they summoned Olmo, and Eärendil stood before their faces and delivered the errand of the two kindreds. Pardon he asked for the Noldor, and pity for their great sorrows, and mercy upon men and elves, and succor in their need. And his prayer was granted. Another one of those wonderful simple sentences at the end of a paragraph. But pardon he asked for the Noldor, and pity for their great sorrows. I think Joe is very right to remind us of how bitter that's got to taste to him right now. If anybody's going to be a little unsympathetic with the sorrows of the Noldor at this particular moment, you know, Eärendil has reason not to be particularly sympathetic. So yes, his status there as intercessor, his petitioning on behalf of everybody, is self-sacrificial not only in the sense that by transgressing this boundary he is yielding up his own life to judgment if they deem that he has broken the ban and he has come. It's not only self-sacrificial in those ways. He has lots of reason to stand there and say, you know, I was going to come and ask you to help the Noldor, but you know what? Screw him, okay? The only Noldor left in Beleriand are the Sons of Feanor, and forget about it, okay? Help everybody but them. But actually, could you smite them? That would be perfectly understandable. But he doesn't do that. And I think that that's clearly... It is clearly important for us to recall how selfless, Joe, as you said, that intercession is there. Now, what do you make of his fate, of his choice? Well, really, of Elwing's choice. Why does Elwing choose what she chooses? Why does she choose the firstborn? Warning, this is a trick question. Dave, go ahead and answer the trick question.
Well, in that case, I believe I have probably been tricked. I was going to point out that they did, in the text, they specifically mention that she chooses because of Luthien.
Yes.
but I don't know what the. Maybe I've just fallen right into the trap. I'm plummeting down into a deep, deep pit at this point, cursing your name.
You have. Well done. No, basically, my question is just, what the heck does that mean? And Elwing chose to be judged among the firstborn children of Iluvatar because of Luthien. Because of Luthien? Like, what does Luthien exactly have to do with that choice?
That's a good point. I mean, Luthien made the exact opposite choice, right?
Right. Obviously, it doesn't mean because of Luthien in the sense of, like, taking Luthien's example because she's doing the opposite of it.
Right. It's quite odd. I wanted to point out before I yield the mic, not directly related, but I did want to point out that I think the really interesting parallel is Aragorn and Arwen, because these two choose with the Eldar and Aragorn and Arwen. I mean, Aragorn sort of had his decision made for him, but in a way they choose with mankind. And in both cases, it's the woman's decision, which is the really important one.
Yes. Now, of course, the huge difference between Eärendil and Elwing and either Beren and Luthien or Aragorn and Arwen is that both partners have a choice because both of them are half-elven, or at least, you know, mixed. Elwing is not exactly half, but anyhow... but Aragorn and Beren don't have choices. I mean, they're mortals, straight up. They're mortals. It's the women who are given the choice. Do you stay with, do you keep the hand you have, or do you, do you lay that down and do you accept it?
You might say in a way, he couldn't choose to actually be immortal, to be with the Eldar. But at the same time, if you look at the example of the Numenoreans, he certainly could have chosen to desire that. And in their dialogue in the appendix, he specifically gets into that they turned away from both the dark and the twilight. So even though he didn't actually have a real choice, he still made a choice in his heart, you might say.
Right. Yeah, which is... thinking especially of Aragorn, because certainly Aragorn in his death scene is the one who sort of most pointedly reverses the choice that the Numenoreans make. So that's certainly true. Other thoughts? Joe, go ahead.
I was leaning more towards almost like the tragedy of Luthien. I mean, yes, she was happy and she was married and everything, but the elves mourned for her pretty much. I mean...
Yes.
Yeah, glad she was happy. I mean, it just seems like that could have influenced her. I mean, it's an entirely different life, and I mean, even though it seems like Elwing was mortal, it just seems like she felt that it was a lesson learned from Luthien, and that just the situation she was in, I mean, it just seems like, okay, that doesn't seem like the right decision. That's all I got.
Yeah, and though I mean, I'm not sure, I wouldn't go so far as to say or to sort of suggest that she's like criticizing Luthien in the sense of like, you know, I'm going to make this choice because of Luthien. Like, so after like Luthien's boneheaded decision to become mortal, like, well, see what a crappy idea that was. So I'm not going to fall into that trap again. Obviously not going quite that far, but Joe, I think you're very right to remember Luthien's choice is tragic, not for her, but for the other elves. And I would just sort of remind you of the last sentence of the chapter on Beren and Luthien on page 187. Yet in her choice, the two kindreds have been joined, and she is the forerunner of many in whom the Eldar see yet, though all the world is changed, the likeness of Luthien the Beloved, whom they have lost. Luthien the Beloved, whom they have lost, is the final note of that story from the perspective of the elves who are still around. So I think that there is a way in which you can see because of Luthien as meaning, I don't want to do that to them too. That is, you know, they've already lost Luthien. I don't want them to, you know, to lose Eärendil too. I don't want them, you know, because this... Recall, this is after already Eärendil has abdicated the choice to her. He says, choose thou, for now I am... So she knows she is choosing on his behalf, too. We don't want them to lose Eärendil as well as Luthien. So because of Luthien, we're not going to go that way. I think that is one way that we could possibly understand it. Jack?
Yeah, while we're on this very chapter, what strikes me as odd about it is something seems to have happened to Eärendil here. I mean, he's lost something. It says that he's weary of the world, but, you know, this is a major decision for both of them, and he's basically saying, I don't know, you decide.
Yeah.
And when she decides, it's not what he wanted, but he doesn't fight it. And it doesn't seem to be just a temporary thing. It seems to be like he is weary of the world. And at a time when you think, well, he's come to Valinor and accomplished the impossible, he should be on top of the world, it seems like he's gone the opposite on the emotional scale or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And his elevation to be made into a star, you know, to be made into a constellation. This is usually a great thing. In many mythologies, it's like deification. He's not only being given the immortality of the elves, but there is an element here which is almost like he's being made a god. That he's being made like one of the Valar themselves, in his ascension into the heavens. Jack, you're absolutely right. This should be the highlight of his career. This should be the great and glorious and splendid, all these words we've been getting, culmination of his career. And we find Eärendil sounding depressed at this moment, and saying, I am weary of the world. We've seen people weary of the world. Fëanor's mom was weary of the world. Húrin, at the end of his life, was weary of the world when he cast himself into the sea. Now we get Eärendil at this moment, weary of the world. And in the one moment when we have what Laura has wanted to see all the way along, that is a husband listening to his wife and doing what his wife chooses. You know, Thingol could have learned something from this. Beren could have learned something from this. Yet, when he does it, it is almost like an act. He sounds defeated rather than victorious. Laura's applauding. Go ahead, Jack.
Feeling about this is maybe I'm just, this is just speculation, but maybe he's like really feeling that he isn't in control of his own destiny. He's seen everything that's come up to this. Now he's getting the sense that this was all predestined for him, and now he's seeing his future also, and he's just lost something.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it is a crucial element in this story. And one of the things which I would call, you know, a characteristically Tolkienian touch at the end of this story is this one element of sadness, this one element of tragedy. Just as Frodo's pain, Frodo's continued suffering and ultimate departure at the end of The Lord of the Rings kind of qualifies the triumph of the Lord of the Rings, and not just the triumph of, you know, hey, like Sauron is defeated and the kingdom is reestablished and everybody's celebrating, but even in a sense the even more, because more personal, glorification of things in the Shire. You know, at the end of the Return of the King, after the scouring of the Shire, we're all set, everything is good, and 1420 rolls around, and nobody was ill, and everybody was pleased. You know, we get all of that kind of language. Everybody's happy, and everything is plenteous, and everything is wonderful, except for Frodo. And he, you know, the one who should be, as Sam thinks, you know, enjoying this most and appreciating this most because he sacrificed most to preserve it, isn't happy and isn't whole. And we get that same thing in Eärendil. This one moment that we get, which I don't want to say undermines the glory of the whole thing, but qualifies it, but contextualizes the glory and the splendor in a way which, as I say, I find just really a signature of Tolkien's thought and of Tolkien's storytelling, and one of the things that I think makes it so complex. But Mike, go ahead.
Is it also kind of signaturely a Tolkienian? As I read this, is it also possible that there was this mixed feeling at the very end, because Eärendil had as I read it, two goals: to reach Valinor and seek pardon for the two kindreds, but also to find his parents.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't that called out very early that
yep.
he was drawn for two reasons? And so at the end of this, he's only accomplished one of his goals. And so there's that unfulfilled desire in his heart that is not going to be fulfilled. There isn't the complete triumph.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. And even, just to add one more level to that, two purposes grew in his heart from the first paragraph here. Two purposes grew in his heart, blended as one in longing for the wide sea. He sought to sail thereon, seeking after Tuor and Idril, who returned not, and he thought to find, perhaps, the last shore, and bring ere he died the messages of elves and men to the Valar in the west. As you say, Mike, one for two, okay, he's batting 500, that's pretty good. But I would also point out, in a sense, he's not just one for two, he's one for three. That is, that these two purposes are blended as one in longing for the wide sea, and from which he's permanently separated. He's still got his ship, and he's still a mariner, and sure, you can say that he is an even greater mariner, and sailing the skies is even more glorious and everything, but it was the sea that he loved, and he can't return to the seas, and he is still a mariner, and the mightiest mariner of song, but he's literally the word mariner means sea, or comes from the word sea, and he's not in the sea anymore. And this is something that we have to remember as well. Manwë chooses to bless him, and not to destroy him. When Manwë says that the power of doom is given to him, he does merge mercy with justice. He doesn't just dismiss Mandos's appeal to justice, because Eärendil is placed under a doom that he can never return, and he seems to be even cut off from the sea there at the end. Dave?
I had two comments. Well, no. I had one comment and one completely trivial question, but it's a curiosity, so I figured I'll ask. Why not? And then I was going to say that you should call on Jordan because he can't raise his hand.
Okay.
My question is, or comment rather, is that the more each subsequent time I read this and the more I listen to you guys discuss it, the more I realize that this is a really tragic story. I mean, for Eärendil and Elwing, at least. It doesn't really turn out happily for them.
Mm-hmm.
Elwing's the one who elects to go with the Eldar and to essentially live forever within the circles of the world. And then she spends eternity waiting for Eärendil to come back.
Right.
He goes off on his ship, and she can't go. And it's just like it was before. He's out sailing around, and she doesn't go, and she sits by the coast or in the tower looking for him and waiting for him. Not terribly happy story. It's sort of like a very bittersweet ending for her. My trivial question was just, I was wondering about the status of the half elven before Manwë makes his judgment. So like, what was Dior? Was he elf? Was he man? What were Eärendil and Elwing and Elrond and Elros, what were all of them, which race were they with before Manwë makes his judgment?
Yeah, good question. We have no idea.
Any answer to that, is there?
No, I don't think so. Especially since it seemed, based on the time frame that we have, the decision point hadn't come yet. That is, Dior doesn't seem to outlive a mortal man in his lifespan. What would have happened? Who knows? But he's killed relatively early. Remember, he barely outlives the death of his parents, who are definitively mortal.
Yes.
He never got the chance to die of old age, so we don't know. That is just, I think, a kind of unanswerable question. But to go back to your other point about Elwing and Eärendil, because I agree, I think that that's a really important thing there, especially when we go back to the parallel between Eärendil and Elwing and Beren and Lúthien that we were looking at before. There is that moment, the moment when Elwing jumps off the ship and comes to him is very Luthien-like. You know, no, we're, you know, our fates shall be joined together. We will face this together. Just as Baron and Luthien are facing the darkness, we're going to face the light, and we shall suffer alike. And except they don't. You know, as you pointed out, Dave, way back, you know, he still says, okay, great, but stay here. I'm going on alone. And in the end, Baron and Luthien can't be separated, even by death. And she tells him, wait for me, you know, tarry for me. And he does. They, you know, even death itself can't separate them and won't separate them. But even immortality can't join Eärendil and Elwing. And as you say, they are caught in this pattern. He chooses to be with her and to have his fate be like to hers. And as a result, he spends most of his time up on his ship and separate from her. And I think that there is an element of tragedy. And I don't think we're supposed to see this as, you know, evidence that Elwing and Eärendil have a dysfunctional relationship, but rather as an element of tragedy. You can see both in recalling what Mike was pointing out about the intimacy and domestic tenderness that we see between Elwing and Eärendil earlier on, but also that image of her, you know, her rising up to come and greet him when he comes in. You know, they clearly, it's not that they don't want to spend time together, but this separation and reunion becomes this cyclical part of their experience now from here on, and they will spend the rest of the time of Arda essentially recapitulating their earlier story when she came to him in the form of a bird and they were reunited after a long separation. Joe, go ahead.
Actually, Jordan, did you want to say something?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yes. Jordan, go ahead, please.
All right. So I'm going to go back a bit. And first of all, with the festival, and then I'll get to my real point about this. How terrifying would it have been to the elves had they not been at festival that stayed behind? Because the last thing they know is the Noldor have killed the Teleri and taken their ships. And now one of them shows back up with a Silmaril.
Right.
And I would imagine their first thought was, oh, they got the Silmarils back. They're here to kill us all.
Right.
When Eärendil ascends into the sky and it's a star, but it's a green star and it's brighter than the other stars in the sky, that's Venus, not a star. Why do you think he's given the status as a star when in reality he's a planet?
This is an illustration of one of the things that Tolkien really struggled with later in his career when he was thinking about redoing a whole bunch of the stuff from the Silmarillion, and he never finished that. You can read about some of his thinking about this in Morgoth's Ring, which is after the Lord of the Rings comes out, and he's doing his in the last part of his life. Tolkien is doing some reconciliation and another round of retcon on the Silmarillion. And one of the things that he struggled with, and we talked about this a little bit during the chapter of the Sun and the Moon, because that was the place where this came most into play for Tolkien. But anyway, he had this problem because the root of the idea of him as star, him as morning and evening star, comes from the idea of a primitive mythology, you know, that he thought in that line from Cynewulf's Crist, the lines that that Brandon quoted that I read about Eärendil, the bright angel. You know, Tolkien's theory was that this is an ancient pre-Christian, a glimpse of a pre-Christian pagan mythology to explain the morning and evening star. And so he incorporated that, and he developed that story, and he told that untold story of Eärendil, or at least he planned to tell it, but never finished telling it, wrote some poems about it. Now, again, the problem that he came to later on in his life was, but wait a second, the elves, I can't have elven mythology be based on that kind of misunderstanding. I mean, on the one hand, one could simply say, oh, Jordan, that's so pedantic. Like, planet, star, what's the difference? The point is it's a celestial body and it looks really bright from the Earth, and that's the whole thing. But Tolkien, at the end of his career, was not thinking of that as a simply pedantic point, because he was saying, look, the elves learn this stuff from the Valar themselves. The Valar are going to know. You know, so you can't just say, like, oh, the world is flat, and then the world is round. Like, the Valar are going to be like, no, dude, the world has always been round, actually. It's a sphere, people. It's not flat. And that's... So, you know, so basically he was going to rewrite the whole thing, recognizing from the beginning within the mythology that the elves couldn't possibly be astronomically inaccurate like that, because the Valar would tell them if they were. So therefore, he's going to have to say, all right, well, yes, the world is a sphere from the beginning, and the sun is there from the beginning, and Eärendil's a planet, not a star. But he doesn't finish that particular round of retcon, for which I'm really grateful. I think the story would really have suffered had he gone there, as I think I said back when we were talking about the sun and moon. But, you know, in function, he is the brightest star. You know, he stands out among the other stars just as Venus, you know, the Venus visibly stands out from the stars in the sky. And certainly it was not always known that that was because Venus was a planet. Now, it was known in ancient times. Ptolemy knew that Venus was a planet, so this is not like something that only modern science has discovered. The entire cosmological system of the ancient Greek world and the Roman and the medieval world, which was based upon the view of the world that was based upon it, all knew that the world was round, and that that those really, really bright stars that you can see, like Venus and Jupiter and Saturn and Mars, are planets rather than just stars like the other stars. But again, you still have that root, especially since that last sentence from Eonwe contains something which is not a translation of the line from Cunewulf, but a recollection of it, certainly. So you still have that kind of mythological element, I want him to be the greatest and brightest of the stars, and so he is referred to simply as a star, because he's certainly not going to be a planet. But Joe, go ahead.
This is moving on to when Eärendil is finally in the sky, and Maedhros speaks to Maglor, and he says, surely that is a Silmaril that shines now in the west. Then Maglor answers and said, if it be truly the Silmaril which we saw cast into the sea that rises again by the power of the Valar, then let us be glad, for its glory is seen now by many and is yet secure from all evil. Now, I think they realize that includes themselves, but technically it seems like their O should be saying, okay, we need to get a really tall ladder and get up there and get that.
Yeah, exactly.
But, no, I mean, the reaction to it is almost like their oath is kind of like no on this. It seems like they could have almost looked to this, as we see later in the chapter, and say, oh, our oath is, I mean, just even from us being able to let go of this one, even though it's, like, different circumstances, I mean, why can't we let go of these other two? It's just their response is just like, okay, slap yourselves in the face later because you guys are idiots. I mean,
yep.
They're just not angry about it, and they're happy about it. They've never, ever, ever been happy about someone else having a Silmaril, whether it was lost to them or not. I mean, yeah, it's a great, beautiful thing, but it seems like their oath was just nullified by this event.
Yeah, I think that this is a really great point, because it is important. This is, I think, one of the clearest places where we can see, in Maglor especially, his will being oriented in a different direction from the oath. Because you're right, Joe, the terms of the oath are that nothing and nobody under any circumstance is going to stand between us and the Silmaril. We don't care who it is, who tries to take it and keep it, we're coming after it. So as you say, like, let's start building a tower. Let's start building a tower. I don't know what the plan is. But the fact that we can't possibly hope to win, hey, that's never stopped us before. That hasn't stopped us from waging this futile war, or at least talking about waging a futile war against Morgoth. And you got to think, if this were Feanor, if Feanor were still alive in Middle-earth, and he were looking up, and he sees the Silmaril rise, he's not going to take that sitting down. He's not just going to roll over. And I
probably would have made a jetpack.
Oh, absolutely, exactly. Yeah, he's gonna devise a way to get up there. But again, it's not just that they give up. It's not just that they don't. But the fact that he expresses Maglor, that is, expresses the joy in sharing it. Let us be glad, for its glory is seen now by many, and is yet secure from all evil. No none of the Feanorians have taken joy in that ever since Feanor first locked them up. Remember that line from, you know, way back in, you know, before Feanor leaves Valinor, when we're told that Feanor locks them away, it denies the sight of them to the Valar and to everybody else, denies them the sight of the Silmarils. Like, he keeps them locked at home and denies them the sight of the Silmarils. He knows everybody likes to see the Silmarils. He knows that everyone sort of basks in the beauty of the light of the trees contained in the Silmarils of Feanor, but he doesn't care because it's his and he wants to keep it to himself. And then here's Maglor saying, "Let us be glad, for its glory is seen now by many." That's not the oath talking. That is anti-oath speak right there. And I agree. I think that it is interesting that here the two of them are not simply saying, "We must follow the oath at all costs." And the fact that they give over on this, and we'll return to this when we come back to the final debate between Maglor and Maedhros, which we shall, of course, have to do next week. The weekly conspiracy to have the discussion go another week has been again successful. And even though this chapter is quite short, obviously a good deal shorter than Durin Turambar, for instance, it treats so briefly so many big things that I feel perfectly okay with taking an extra week on this. So let us stop here. This is actually an excellent stopping point here, and we will commence with the War of Wrath next time. Any final thoughts, comments before we adjourn for the evening?
One more week.
Yes, Jordan. One more week. Okay. Thanks, everybody. So we will do one more week on Eärendil next time, and then it is off to the Akalabaeth and the story of Numenor. Okay. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, everyone who has been listening on Middle-earth Network Radio. And we will see you guys next week. Night.
Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.